Resuming now with tape two, I'm speaking with Christos John here in Worcester, Massachusetts. We'll start here with your impression when you came to Ellis Island.
First, enter Ellis Island. Naturally, like I said before, the reason we went through Ellis Island is because my brother and sister had the measles, and because they were taken to the hospital at Ellis Island, my mother and I had to also be quarantined at Ellis Island until my brother and sister got much better. Now, as I entered Ellis Island, I was amazed at this huge building at that time. And walking into it, of course, not so much the first day there, because I think it was more late in the evening. You couldn't see too much, I mean, at that time, naturally. But I remember they gave us a small bedroom on the let's see, there was a first floor, second floor, and there was another floor on top of that, like a third floor, around this big, big hallway. Big, and I can see the dome, like, and so forth. But around like, a, over, you know, you could see from a balcony on the, this huge hall, there were separate rooms, different rooms. And we were given one room, my mother and I. She had a large bed, and I had a little cot beside it. The room was very small. All they had was a sink there. And, of course, they had a toilet, small facilities for that, too. And a faucet for water and a sink. And we slept there during our stay there. In the morning, we would get up. They would wake us up, and they would take us down to breakfast. Down, way down to the first floor again, because we, I remember walking down stairways. It's not there this time, because I noticed it was taken out and must have been changed around. And going up and down there to, for our meals down there and so forth. And most of the day we spent in this big, big hallway there. And that used to have there for activities a big puzzle, I remember, the whole table, a big, big table is covered with this huge puzzle. And every time we try to find a piece to put on there, I used to spend a lot of time trying to find a piece to fit into the puzzle. It was only half completed at the time, and it was half completed when I left, and I remember. And other things that I remember while I was there, seeing my very first Oriental. And in a way, I was kind of leery. You know, he looked a little strange to me. And I remember he was always close to me, sticking close to me, because he was a young fella also. It must have been my age, apparently. Because he probably wanted, you know, somebody my age there to follow. I didn't realize it. And I was kind of, but we got to be, you know, we could understand each other. He had his own language. I had my own language. I didn't know how to speak English at that time. All I knew was the Greek language and a little Albanian, which I learned for about a year and a half when I was in school. And but we couldn't have stayed there too long, because I remember for a couple of days only, two or three days the most. And but that was my first experience with someone that didn't look, you know, like a regular European. So well, because I've never seen anyone other than Europeans while I was in Albania. The only other ones I remember, Muslims, some women, I went to this Argyro Orchestra there, they used to have, women used to have their faces covered up. All you could see is the eyes. They used to look strange to me at that time. I said, who are they? Why are they dressed like that? Because in our village, we were regular. The Greeks, we had Greek customs and so forth, nothing like that. And something new. And okay, that's the only other thing I remember, is that young people being there. Other than this fellow, I don't remember anybody. Oh yeah, there was a couple others, but where they came from, I don't unless they were children or workers there, because I remember this young lady taking me and a few other, maybe three or four, we went outside to a garden, like enclosed with a fence. They had swings there, and they had a big beach ball we used to throw around and get into the swings. And I remember one other thing that on the swings there, I wasn't used to them, because we never had swings like that in the old country that you could go, you know, and the air used to make me ill. Oh, I used to get dizzy going up and down with that swing there. I was leery about it. And I remember playing with the beach ball, throwing it to the other children, and the teacher used to be in there to keep us busy during the day. The food I remember, of course, any food that I ate while I was there or in this country was delicious compared to what we used to, eat back home, because we never had, like I said, we had the, was good whatever we ate and made, but it was nothing like what was served at Ellis Island. It was very good. And of course, I had that experience for the food that was served us on the boat, which was very good at, in Italy when we ate there. And a couple of days when I was in Tehran and so forth, at, but my stay at Ellis Island was very, very pleasant. I enjoyed it. I wasn't scared one time. I remember also there my mother met this other woman who happened to be Greek, one other woman, and they were talking. For what reason she was there, I don't remember, but reading about it now, I realize who was there at that time or after that time. There weren't just regular people coming into this country for immigration purposes, because I think at that time they didn't have to go through Ellis Island. The only ones that went to Ellis Island at that time was people like in my category, where I had to be quarantined until my brother and sister got well, better, and people that didn't have proper credentials and so forth.
That's right. Yeah. Were you in steerage when you were coming over? Were you in a cabin?
We were in this big room about this size, about, how many feet would you say here? Anyway, it's 50 feet. It's like a hospital ward. They had a nurse there. All day long, she was there, night and day, along with us. I used to sleep on one of the beds, a cot-like, on one end of the room. My brother and sister were in the very other end of the room, all by themselves. So we weren't even near them in the hospital.
There was no partition.
No partition, but they were all by themselves. And my father and mother also had separate cots on the end of where I was, at the beginning where the nurse was. I was very close to the nurse there, make the first bed near where the nurse was sitting there, and make sure we used to have. And I remember an unusual thing. Like I say, electricity, we never had any electricity back home. And what little electricity that I knew about was, of course, hotel, and in Italy there we stayed at a hotel overnight before we went to the boat. I remember an elevator, first time I ever saw an elevator. This hotel, this small elevator, going up to the hotel there. A lot of new things that I've witnessed.
You were saying the room that
was... Oh, the room, yeah.
This was
okay.
On the ship? Or
on the boat, on the boat. And the very at the bottom of the boat, you could see that the windows, maybe the windows are long there. You know, you could see out, like potholes, not the windows, the portholes. Yeah. You could see out to the ocean there. So I used to spend a lot of time looking out the porthole.
Was that room filled with people?
No, we were the only ones.
The
only ones, and the only reason was because they happened to catch the symptoms of the measles at that time. Otherwise, they wouldn't have allowed them to begin with. If somebody got sick during the voyage, they bring him down there. But nobody got sick during the voyage, other than there was just my brother and sister there. And we had to stay there because they didn't know whether we'd come out with the symptoms. They didn't want to spread the measles throughout the boat. Now, remember one time trying to go up the stairs to go up, I was curious, and there was a guard up there. Hey, hold on, you can't come up there, you go right down back again. So that was that. That was the only try I made, trying to go out and see what the rest of the boat looked like. They wouldn't let me go out. And and talking about the food there, which was good and so forth, but I remember then my mother must also have some Easter eggs in something that she was carrying or something with her. So one time she gave me this egg. I was going to peel it and eat it. The nurse noticed it. Oh, she must have said, you can't have that. But she said, no. She grabbed the egg and she brought me some eggs after that separately to eat, those Easter eggs. So that was an experience that I remember on the boat. Then, of course, after a week or so, maybe 10 days to 2 weeks, took that long, I think, they got over the measles, they were healthy again. And my father, meanwhile, they let my father go. See, my mother and I were the only ones left at the Ellis Island.
Were the three of you staying in a room all by yourselves?
You mean on the boat?
On Ellis Island.
On Ellis Island, just my mother and I. My brother and sister were in the hospital, separate building entirely.
And you and your mother had a separate room, and your father left?
My father was allowed to go back to his business, made preparations for us to get into the, you know, to go to wherever we were going to go. And after the they were cleared to leave Ellis Island, he came and he took us, and my brother and sister, myself and my mother. And we had a cousin of mine who lived in Niantic, Connecticut at that time, had come down with his car and picked us up, and came to this. He had shipped separately. Meanwhile, the other trunk that he had, where we had full of stuff, he had already taken care of it. Apparently, he had it shipped already to my cousin's house in Niantic, Connecticut. And until we found a home, and he found a house for us in Taunton, Massachusetts. That's where he had a business there, the A1 restaurant. He was in partners with one other Greek man, and they used to do very good business there at that time. That's how apparently he was able to do what he did to bring us over, because he was successful.
Do you remember any first things that you saw for the first time when you?
The first thing that stuck in my mind is how amazed I was at the tall buildings in New York City. I remember we were apparently in the car. Naturally, he must have picked us up at the where the boats land there, or what they call that now, the wharf there, where the one that they use now to ferry that you go to Ellis Island, Statue of Liberty, around that same area. From there, we got in the car, and naturally, I don't know what route he took. My cousin, but we didn't stay long in New York. Just drove through it. And I was looking out the window, looking at the buildings. I was amazed at them. I was amazed at what he was going through there. First time I ever saw anything like that. Closest was, of course, in Tehran, which is nothing. It was just the one hotel and nothing else. And no tall buildings at all. Even in Italy, I don't remember other than the hotel there any other tall buildings where I went through anyway, at least, because I didn't see too much there because it was nighttime. Going through there nighttime on this train, and then we got to the other end of Italy from the west east side to the west side to pick up the boat. And other than the hotel that we stayed there overnight, I don't remember much else.
Do you remember your uncle's name, the one who picked
his
you
first
up?
Name was Pericles. Oh my, no, that was my cousin. That happened to be my aunt, my father's sister's son.
Oh.
Okay, from the old country. They had left earlier they were there also originally. They had come before us here, like a few years earlier. Mm-hmm. And his name was Socrates. Now, he had not a saint's name. That's an unusual part that some don't have. There's no celebration for Socrates for name day. One of the ancient Greek names, Socrates. Naturally, you know who Socrates was. They named after the other name, Greek names, a lot of them they had, like Socrates, Hercules, and things like that. Aristoteles. So he had a business at that time, a very successful business in Niantic, Connecticut. His name was Socrates Deli George. Deli Yorgi. Yorgi was George. Yorgi. In Greek is George. That's how they translate Yorios, St. George. I use Yorios in Greek. And that's the one that slayed the dragon, apparently. Remember, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he had, his wife was with him. Naturally, he had brought the whole family over. He had also, at that time, I remember, two other sons at that time. One was about my age, one was a little bit older. And we must have spent there at least a month in Niantic, Connecticut. It was a small town there outside of New London, and it was one of the best times of my life that I spent down there. It was springtime at that time, must have been May, and he had beautiful grounds there in his house. He had a nice big house. He had a lot of trees, like fruit trees. I don't know what kind would they have around here at that time, but anyway. Apple trees, yeah. And we waited there, naturally, and then he was right near the beach there, which I've never seen. The only ocean that I saw was the Adriatic Ocean when I got on the boat in the Atlantic Ocean. And I was amazed at the beaches. They had to go swimming, which I never went swimming. There was never near any body of water to go swimming where I was born. I never learned how to swim on account of that. The only body of water we used to have there through the valley during the summer months, only one river that used to go run through the whole valley. And during the winter months, when they got a lot of rain and so forth, whenever they got, they had another river, two rivers, but one used to go dry in the summer months, and another one used to be constantly way further away from us. Just to go back to one more minute about talking, they were talking about the water there. Water, we never had any running water in these villages. We used to go down at the bottom in the valley, we used to have a big well, and people used to go there with barrels on their donkeys, fill them up with water and bring them back home. And the summer months was really tough. We had to go miles to this other river, which we used to have near this other river, but they used to have some pipes there. They used to have water from the mountains from the Greek side. And they used to have the water, there was constantly water there through a, we used to call Vrissi, pipes coming through there. We used to go there to fill up with barrels and bring it all the way back home during the summer months. It was really tough living there, the conditions.
So this was the first time you had...
First time that I had living near there to go swimming and so forth. And of course, I couldn't swim anyway, but we used to go near the beach there, and I used to enjoy it so much. Then, of course, after my father found a home in Taunton to rent, a place to rent, we moved to Taunton, entirely different from Niantic, because Taunton's more in the center of Massachusetts there. Well, actually, not too much in the center. This is in Worcester, center of Massachusetts, but Taunton is... about 50 miles from here.
Yeah, it's not
more
right
towards
the
Cape.
Ocean.
It's not on the ocean, but it's inland. It's south of Boston, and it used to be the gateway to the Cape at one time. The only road that you used to go through, you used to go through Taunton, from here, this part of the country, from Worcester. You used to have to drive through Route 140 through Taunton to go down to the Cape, I remember. And Taunton was a nice, clean city to live on. Poor, wasn't that that much wealth there, but the first home we went to was a very small little house, only about four rooms on it. It was by a river in the backyard, but the river was a very dirty water. There was it wasn't swimmable. It wasn't those years. I don't know, but it's probably cleaned up now, but. Rubbish used to be thrown, and I remember tires and all that in the back there that was thrown. We didn't stay there too long, fortunately. Maybe a few, 2-3 months. Then we moved to another house, which was more or less a three-decker. We were on the second floor. In Taunton. We went to three different houses. Then after that one, we moved to another three-decker to the very top floor, which was right near the high school. And remember the high school right across the street? The house was across the street was the high school.
Meanwhile,
they're very interestingly enough. Of course, here I was 11 years old, 11 and a half years old. Now, where could they put me in school? So we came here in May after schools had closed in beginning of June. So I had to wait till September. But they sent me, they had a special class in Taunton. I remember this lovely teacher. She was an elderly woman, maybe in her 60s at that time. Gray-haired woman, I remember. But she had an Irish name. I think her name was Riley, Miss Riley. And she was a sweet, sweet lady. I mean, she had the patience to teach us, I don't know. But. I remember that schoolroom there, Barnum Street School, they used to call it. It's a special room for special students who couldn't speak English to learn how to speak and write English, to learn the alphabet. And I remember in that class, the first thing that I used to look around all the time was these big letters all around the room, the alphabet from A to Z, small and the large capitals and all that. First thing I learned. It helped me a lot because the Greek language, you see, a lot of those letters are very similar to the, and if you pronounce them, there isn't that much difference. When A, alpha, B, beta, in Greek. Mm-hmm. C was a different than the second. But anyway, you go down there, but a lot of the letters are, and you could, if you formed it properly, and then, back home, the Greek schools were very thorough. They used to teach you good, remember, I just went about, couldn't have gone more than three and a half years, 4 years in Greek school, and I learned how to to read and write and so forth. And also the English, the Albanian language helped me a lot, because the Albanian language is a lot, although a lot of it was derived from the Greek language, but it was a lot in the letters and so forth, and it was similar to the American language. So I was able to pick it up pretty quick. And at that age, you tend to learn more fast at that time, but if you concentrate and apply yourself. Mm-hmm. And like I say, this teacher was very good. We used to sit around on a table. There was about 7 or 8 of us. There was a couple from Italy, I remember. There was a couple from Portugal. But mostly in Taunton, there were a lot of Italian and Portuguese. There were a lot of Portuguese in Taunton. My sister-in-law, by the way, Jimmy's, my brother's wife is Portuguese. That's where my brother met his wife there. And each one, of course, and I remember them, we went through, but I don't know how the others did it, but I remember leaving the school. We used to, with the other students, and probably the same direction, we used to walk to our homes, and that was quite an experience. But anyway, after a year there, and a half, I think, then after that, they transferred me for half a year to the fifth grade, to the grammar school. From there on, I went right up, 6, 7.
You mean you started out in the first again?
No.
Oh, no, you started.
The special class brought me up to the fifth grade. I had learned enough to be able to be put in the fifth grade.
Right.
But I was 2 years over in the, 2 years behind then. I was always 2 years older than any of my students.
I see.
Other the students there in the class, because I started fifth grade when I was about, 13 years mm-hmm. old. Mm-hmm. That was the only disadvantage. Other than that, was I had wonderful experiences going through grammar school, middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grades, and I went to high school. Now, talking about the different homes we moved to, right when I started high school, we had moved from that house. We was near high school here, so I was looking forward to going to school right next door. But my father had finally bought his own home, a single-family house about couple of 3 miles on the outskirts of Taunton there, nice, a lot of land there. And so I had to walk to high school all those, that time. The rain or snow, I never missed a day. I used to walk to high school. Now, just to bring one other thing I should mention here at this time. After we came to this country, my father, my grandfather and grandmother back in the old country, my grandmother passed away after 2 or 3 years later. My grandfather was left all alone. My father brought him over. Mm-hmm. He was in his 90s.
This is the grandfather
my grandfather that we grew up with.
Uh-huh.
Brought him into Taunton. And he was, he was so happy, He was a great man. Even he was always working, even at that age, because we had this, my father had bought this the house there, we had like a lot of apple trees there in the backyard, and we had a grapevine there, and an area for gardening. The first thing he did up there, he had a garden there, he trimmed the grapevines, he was paying attention to the apple trees, he enjoyed himself. And then, of course, naturally, this was had to be 1936 or 37 that he came up. And of course, during school and during my high school and so forth, he was there, so I was going to school. But we spent a lot of happy years together. Then to prolong things here. I graduated from high school, naturally. Right at that time, that's when the World War II, that's when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in 1942. Yeah.
Today, actually the anniversary.
Right, December 7th, today. Yeah. And I remember the day that they were called an assembly, all the high school students in this big assembly room in high school. And there we heard the radio address of President Roosevelt. Addressing, saying that the infamous day, Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, declare war against Japan, and of course it started drafting, and naturally I was just graduating that year, That was my last. Well, what month was it that the bombed Pearl Harbor? It had to be near the end of the beginning of December 7th. Okay, yeah, December 7th. So of course we had to, I completed it. So I stayed in school through the end of the year, and my name was in the draft, and they drafted me, right? They had an out at that time, I remember. They're saying that they had some kind of a project in Quarry, Maine, that they were working for the government. And they say anybody that graduated, they had this government officials, you know, draft where I was running the draft and so forth. And they say anybody that wants to join this endeavor at Quarry, Maine to work there would be deferred temporarily from the draft. And I volunteered, you know, not that I didn't want to go to war, of course. So but anyway, it worked out that I during that summer when I graduated from high school, of course I want to say this, that I all during my even high school, and I was working part time after high school, and there were people were helping me a lot. They knew my situation going up, and I had some wonderful teachers that I want to say that they helped me a lot, because I remember going to the when I went to the sixth grade. They put me, they had divisions, A, B, C division for students according to the grades they were getting. So they put me in the B division on my first semester. Then they put me in the A division because I was doing so well. And I was right through my, always an honor student. And I was always applying myself for my best. And I had this, I remember this in high school, a fellow by the name of Decker. He's the one that convinced me to take business courses in high school instead of the other, you know, languages and so forth, because I was good at arithmetic and things like that. So I took the business course there, naturally office practice and all that, where it was with business. And naturally, then the war started. Eventually was drafted by in October of that same year, 42.
You went to Quarry, Maine?
No, I didn't go. They, for some reason, didn't pan out or something, so they didn't go through. For some reason, they had to wait further up. I don't know if they ever did anything with later on, but since they must have given up on that project, they got drafted in October. And I went through, I remember getting drafted. I went to Fort Devens in Massachusetts here, and I had some lucky experiences, actually. Fortunately, I don't know, maybe God was with me. But like I said, I had worked all during those summer months. I worked building up this the camp at Miles Standish for the soldier embarkation point there. They were building a, so I worked there during the summer, working on building barracks and things like that for this for the camp, Camp Miles Standish. So I had a part in even war work at that time. I got drafted, and fortunately, my fortunes, even during wartime, was outstanding. I enjoyed it. You know, others have horrible experiences, but for some reason, I got drafted in October, November. I was, that time, they were trying to raise, they're building the Air Forces, the Army Air Forces. The Air Forces were in separate unit at that time, Army Air Forces and Navy Air Forces and so forth, like the Marines and so forth. It's about part of the Navy. Air Forces were part of the Naval Air Force and Army Air Forces. And they sent me, first time outside of Massachusetts and Connecticut, to Miami Beach for my basic training. And there, about a month or so, 2 months, then they, after we got the basic training, they decided, because of my experiences and my good grades in school and so forth, they sent me to Louisiana State University for Army Administration. Went there for about, spent there 3 months at the Louisiana, learning all about Army administration purposes. Then, lo and behold, they shipped me back to to Fort Devens. And at Fort Devens, they were starting there at that time. Oh, not at Fort Devens, here in Massachusetts, there was an Air Force base down by Springfield. I forgot the name of it right now. They're outside of Springfield at Chicopee Falls, there was an Army base, a Westover Air Base. They formed the what they call the Airborne Engineers. I was assigned to battalion headquarters, just starting a new battalion, the 82nd Airborne Engineers, Army Airborne Engineers. And for the purpose of those battalions, of course, were to build the airstrips for the fighter pilots. And they only had three battalions of those. One went to the Asia, Middle East, not Middle East, but by Burma and those areas there. And they had bad experiences there. See, that's where I was lucky. If I could have been sent on that battalion, I would have ended up in Burma. A lot of them were trying to land behind enemy lines where they used to land us to build airstrips. A lot of them got really banged up. Well, ended up anyway after all the training, or they shipped us to the Far East. I mean, to the the Pacific area. By boat, we went to California, got on a boat. We went to New Zealand, Australia, up to Port Moresby in New Guinea, and here we were building all either hospitals, roads, or airstrips. Working on airstrips mostly, but that was our aim, to airstrips, because the bombers could go further than the fighter pilots to bomb the Japanese targets further north, you know, as far as even into Japan. But they need to have air cover. Now the fighters, they didn't have a distance. They couldn't go at the same distance, travel at the same distance as the bombers. So that we had to go behind enemy lines in the mountains. Yeah, I remember New Guinea, in the middle of New Guinea there. They landed us on this valley, something like what reminded me of my country back home, this big valley there, and we built airstrips there for the fighters there to land there, refuel, and continue on to escort the bombers. So that was our aim there. And then, of course, we went right up the line. Meanwhile, the closest we came to battle was when we were threatened by Japanese. They were trapped by the Australians. They were driving them north, and we were behind enemy lines in the northern part of New Guinea. We had gone all the way up there, and we were in battle form trying to anticipate the Japanese moving northward to stop them there. But they didn't materialize because they were caught up, and they were awful. Well, anyway, from that we landed in the Philippines and Okinawa, and finally ended up in Japan, my outfit. So I was with a lucky outfit. So closest I came to being a casualty was when we're loading an LSD, because instead of carrying anything by plane to the Philippines, not the Philippines, from the Philippines to New Guinea, Philippines to Okinawa, I had an accident when we loaded all of our equipment and everything else on this LST. It's a boat that carried our equipment that we needed. And I fell and I broke my wrist. And here we were ready to leave in a couple of days. So at nighttime there, it was nighttime, I got home, I got this pain here. And I went to the medic, I said, this pain is killing me, I can't sleep. He says, I'll take an aspirin, see him in the morning, family expression. So he gave me an aspirin. But the next day I went to the field hospital. They examine x-ray, you got a fracture in your thing there. They put a cast on and all that. Okay, I said, now I can go. Where are you going? He says, well, I got to go. We're getting packed ready to leave. Where do you think you're going? You can't go. What do you mean I can't go? He says, I'm already packed. Everything is packed. I was in charge of the post exchange besides, because of my experiences in the restaurant business with my father and all that. Put me in charge of the post exchange. I said, I gotta go. I can't have, I got merchandise lined up on that. Who's gonna take care of this? I'm like, you can't go unless you get a letter from your commanding officer that they allow you to go. Here I go. I said, now I gotta go find the commanding officer. I went and I saw the first sergeant, actually. Hey, sergeant says, it's just a fracture here. I said, I can move my arm and there's nothing wrong. He said, but they won't let me go unless you get a letter here from the company commander that they're allowed to go. So he signs a letter for me, and I went. Here I had an opportunity to stay behind. Yeah. The guy says to me, you're crazy, the doctor says to me. Do you realize where you're going? He says they're having a big battle. He says they're just, the Japanese are hari-kari. They're landing their planes on the ships and so forth. I says, well, I'll take chance I got to take. he has a chance to probably go back to Australia, and all the way home, instead I stayed till the very end of the war.
You know why you opted to go when you could have stayed?
Well, because I enjoyed, you know, what this my battalion was doing, what we were doing, and I never experienced any close combat. So I never, you know, young fellow at that time, adventure. You wanted to go on fighting, whatever it is. If you had to fight, you fight. You know, we had always had a rifle with us, naturally, and all that, or combat packs and all that. We're ready for fighting also when the occasion arose. But we never came to the point where we had to face somebody face to face. And the closest, like I said, I came to that was when we got strafed a few times when we were at this valley. Japanese planes came over to strafe us, but there was no casualty of any kind, so they weren't able to do it. And I remember seeing closest I came to actual fighting, to see actual fighting, when our fighter pilots that we had there on the valley, we had bit the strip for and so forth, they got up and chased him and shot him down. I actually witnessed that, our plane shooting down this Japanese plane. So other than that, and then the only other, oh, there's so many stories to tell, I'm taking too much of your time.
No.
But in Okinawa, for instance, there was that island was a lot of caves, a lot of hills and caves there, and mountains. And I remember we built battalion the headquarters on top of this hill, and we had a bulldozers level it off and put battalion headquarters right on top of it. But we and meanwhile the Marines were just on the other side. We were between the Marines actually and where the Japanese were trapped on this part of the island. And they were shooting artillery over our heads and we didn't see nothing of it. Imagine that. And now while we were leveling off that area there for battalion headquarters, there was a cave underneath, apparently, which never knew about. And when we leveled it off, we blocked that entrance to the cave and so forth. And there was two Japanese underneath, soldiers on inside there. A couple of days later, one of our was on guard duty early morning. You know, we always have guards, no matter where you are. We always have guards on duty, you know. That. And sees this white flag coming through the rocks. And finally, you know, I reported the company commander went up there, they dug it open, and there's a cave entrance, but the Japanese wouldn't come out. They were scared, probably. They were afraid, naturally, because the Marines that time, they go through every cave. Is anybody in there? One, two, three, come out or not, and then they throw hand grenades in there. And but we didn't do that, naturally, so And I remember a cook, a Greek too, he was a cook at the headquarters there, the cook. And he volunteered along with a second lieutenant. They go into the cave after the Japanese and they brought him out of here all bearded up and all that. They had enough water, they probably food they ran out of. That's why they surrendered anyway. And we had called the Marines and they came by and took him away. But the Marines really gave us, they says, you people have to be stupid, he says, to go in after him. You don't go after, and he says, you give them a chance to come out. If they don't, that's it. So that's an experience I never forgot.
Mm. Well, now, when you got out of the service, what did you do then?
Okay, after I got out of the service, they give you indoctrination. They tell you what you're going to do, how to do about it, what you plan to do. They give you indoctrination when you go back to civilian life and so forth. They tell us about the Bill of Rights. And I said, so I was saying, well, I'm going to say I'll go to work for my father in a restaurant. Then I says, no, I'm going to decide to go to college because they were, you know, the government at that time. Well, I got out in November, right? I couldn't start school at that time right away. So I had to wait through January or February, I think. And I decided to go to it. Meanwhile, they used to pay us, of course. We used to call it the 50 club or something like that. For 50-52 club. For 52 weeks, the government would give the soldiers, they were released $50 a week. For 52 weeks. So I collected the $50 until I went, tried to get into college. I got into to the college in Providence, Rhode Island there, which is right near Taunton. Taunton and Providence only about 20 miles apart. Mm-hmm. There, at the see now, I can't even remember the name of my school, which I know it very well, and it's quite a college now. It's the it's a business school. Anyway, I went there for February on for because they were really loaded with GIs at that time under the GI Bill. Every college at that time, all the GIs that got released from the Army went to college. I don't say all of them, but actually the good majority took advantage of it. And I went there, they paid all the tuition, and besides that, they were giving us about, I forget what it was, about $100 a month or something for our expenses. So I went for 2.5 years to continuously, summer and winter. In other words, 4-year course, and I finished in 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. Took accounting, and I became an accountant. After that, I moved to, meanwhile, I had met my wife, naturally.
Where did you meet her?
Now, where Worcester comes in. Taunton naturally had no church there. We had a lot of relatives here. I had a cousin here. The cousin that I witnessed the marriage back in the old country had moved and was living in Worcester. My uncle, Pericles, was living in Worcester. That was the father of this, my cousin got married. I was talking about the wedding back home. Meanwhile, my father had also Brent, my other cousin, his son, my uncle's son, who was in Buenos Aires, because my father was a citizen, and he brought him over as an uncle to bring him to this country. He stayed with us in Taunton for a while and then moved to Worcester here, you know, with his father and sister and so forth. And I used to come to Worcester quite often, naturally. I used to come to dances here. We had no dances in Taunton because we had no Greek community. There's only about 4 or 5 families, Greek families in Taunton. We used to belong to the Fall River Church. And but I used to come to Worcester here quite often. And my cousin, the one that I witnessed the marriage, introduced me, invited me to the same wedding that she was invited to. We went to this wedding. We met at the wedding. That's where I first met her. Yeah. And it's like almost you could say, well, it was a fixed marriage. But then we got married. And
was she from?
No, her folks come from the same part of the country that I was there, but a few villages further down. Her folks from there. They had come over here, and she was born in this country. Mm-hmm. She's about my age, maybe a little bit younger, about a year younger. But she has the same customs, you know, same customs we have, and all the Greek customs and all that. So she speaks Greek very. She learned Greek. She went to Greek school here in Worcester. She learned Greek and the English language. Of course, she went through high school. We got married in 1946. I got out in late 1945 from the service, 1946, in September. What was it? When is Labor Day? The end of September? Mm-hmm. Is that Labor Day?
The beginning.
The beginning. So, well, about that time we got married. About that time, and she lived in Taunton. We lived in Taunton for a couple of years until I graduated from college. Then, when I graduated from college, we moved to Worcester here.
Now, your father was in business in Taunton?
Was in this A1 restaurant right through all those years. He was in the A1 restaurant in the business there. But for a while during the war, it had changed because they couldn't get help at that time. It turned into a cafeteria, into a regular restaurant where you serve people. There, a lot of restaurants had turned to cafeteria during the war because they couldn't get the help to serve people. And then, of course, he was getting he had asthma. He was a little, wasn't feeling good. Was asthma bothering him a lot. And he was working in Taunton right till, well, my grandfather, meanwhile, when I came back from the service, by the way, he had gone blind, completely blind. He, back in the village, he had been kicked on one side of the head there by a mule or something, and he had lost sight of one eye. He could see very well when he came to this country, but after I came back from the service, he couldn't see at all. But I took him to Mass General Hospital, trying to see if anything could be done. I think the condenser's nerves are completely gone. But he lived, even when he was blind, he used to get along very well, I remember. And he even came to my wedding. He was at the wedding there, and he lived a good old age, about 90, he must have been 98 years old, something like that, when he passed away.
What is your wife's name?
Sophia. And wisdom. That stands for wisdom.
Does it,
yeah,
Sophia?
Yeah.
And how about her maiden name?
Chanis, Chanis, Sophia Chanis was her friend. And of course, we got married, like I said. We had four wonderful children up there, two boys and two girls. They're all doing very well. One lives in New York City. That's when I went recently there, and he took us, and we went to Ellis Island.
Uh-huh. What are your children's names?
The oldest one is William, Vasilios in Greek, George, two boys, and then the girl, Christina, named after Christina, and the youngest one, Constantina. Mm-hmm. And they're all married, and I have six grandchildren. One, of course, George, the youngest one, is an investment banker in New York City at the, what's it, two Twin Towers there. Was at
the
World Trade Center's office is there. He works right now. He started actually, my youngest son of all of them, my oldest son did very well too. He's a regional manager for a pharmaceutical company. He lives in Hampton, the oldest son. It's the one I thought where they live, where I went to make the speech on Ellis Island.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And my two daughters are married. And you know, you you wonder why, I mean, Greek customs and all that, but once they get to this country, it's a funny thing. They even though all my grandchildren, my children, right, my four children, went through Greek school here in this, where we're having the interview right here.
The Greek school, now would they be attending
this is only about two or three times a week, afternoon, after regular schooling. They come for a couple hours here and learn Greek, how to speak and write and so forth. And they go through grades, well, maybe four or five grades for 4 or 5 years, and then they graduate. They have Sunday school every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And my kids all went through Sunday school, Greek school. They grew up with it, you know, they played sports for the church, basketball and so forth and so on. And yet, none of them married a Greek. They all married different.
How do you feel about that?
I have wonderful, I'm telling you, every one of them, so they're all so happy and they're all doing very well. I never felt anything bad about it. My folks were very upset, not of my children married, but because my brother Jimmy married a non-Greek. My mother was really upset. And my sister almost married a non-Greek. She was so upset about it. You know, she fought hard and tooth to marry Greeks, you know. So of all the ones in my family that actually married Greeks was myself, my younger sister, mm-hmm. or my older sister, Jimmy's twin married a Greek fellow also. But the younger ones, well, the younger sister married a Greek also, but my other two brothers, other brother married an Italian girl, and my other brother married a Greek originally, but they got divorced and he's married to another girl. So, but the children, our children,
right.
My children all married different, and my brother's children, they're married, not married to Greeks, and neither my younger sister, they marry Greeks. My sister's the twin there, or my Jimmy's twin sister, didn't marry. Her children didn't marry any Greeks, so we're really spread out. Different. I never seen so. I have a Polish son-in-law, an Italian, half Italian, half French son-in-law. My oldest son married a German girl. He had an accident of some kind playing basketball. He's 6'5" and a half tall. He was playing basketball. He had some kind of a muscle pull or something on his leg. He ended up in the hospital. And she was a nurse for him there. And that's where he met her. and my youngest son married an Armenian girl.
Right.
But they're all doing very well.
Well, do you yourself carry on any customs?
All the Greek customs, we follow through them. I've always stayed with the Greek customs myself, especially my wife. We brought up in, after we got married. We got married in this church, by the way.
Oh.
We came from Taunton and got married in this church because she was here anyway from Worcester. Usually, ordinarily, the custom is that we get married in the bride's church. So we got married here, and when we moved, eventually after we graduated, I moved here naturally. I was a member here, and I remember right at that time we had started building. That's when we started raising money to build this church here. Before we had one in downtown on Orange Street, which has been changed entirely now from redeveloping. The building was torn down there. But we built this church here, and I remember we were talking about the not the founders, but the benefactors of this church, which two outstanding ones with Mr. Kotsidas and Mr. Tona. They were in the building fund committee, raising money and so forth. When the time come to build it, they had raised enough money to build it, and I remember it to the very end. We ended up without a mortgage, which cost at that time, of course, it wasn't as expensive to build it, but it cost us over $500,000. And at the end, instead of having a mortgage, they paid off everything, so there would be no mortgage left. And I remember after that, they built the church. They says, now we're ready to retire, because there were all these older gentlemen, the board of directors, or the board of governors of the church. They were the ones that went through building the church. They said, well, we're now turning over to you young fellas to take over running the church. And I remember I was here a few years ago. This was in, of course, I moved to Worcester in 1948, 49, and this happened about 1953, 54. And I remember on the elections of, to point out, you mentioned earlier a person's name, of all the older board of governors, they were running at that. They were running the building during the building of the church and completion of the church. Only one board of directors was stayed on to run again into the. We were only electing about seven at that time. Now we're 15, and that was Nicholas Drapus. He was president. We elected him. I remember I was one that ran at that time, and I was fortunate to come in the seventh person in, and I was almost tied with the eighth person. So they flipped the coin or something, so I got in because I was younger. This other fellow was another older person. They says, "Oh, give this young fellow a chance." So he says, oh, "Okay, I'll let him take the position," and we elected Nicholas Drapus at that time the president, and we went right there for a few years. Now we have elections every 2 years. Every 2 years you run for 2 year term and then a 2 year term maximum of four. Then you have to lay off and give somebody else a chance and to run again later. So I ran for the 4 years, and then after that I gave up for a couple of years and I ran again and I had another four years or so. So I followed the customs of the church, and then I remember the time that we built this, for instance, where we're having an interview right now, the center, the Greek school, the hall, and this is the reception center. This is, by the way, is named after Mr. Tona. They call this the Tona Room. And I remember Mr. Kotsidas, Mr. Tona, and a few other leaders got together at a luncheon in the Aurora Hotel, which was owned by a Greek at that time. This big hall, he had like a luncheon, I mean a hall for for affairs. We had invited the Archbishop at that time, and they had invited about 80 business people of the Worcester area. We went at this meeting, and Mr. Tona, Mr. Kotsidas, and the priest who was around at the time, they got up and spoke. Now has come the time to build this center after a few years. That was in the late 50s, 58, I think it was my 59, around that time. And I was, of course, at that time my brother and I had bought this restaurant down, not a restaurant actually, so there was the bus terminal, which had all the rights to all the selling newspapers, magazines, a luncheonette and all that. And they says, okay, now here's the story, they said. Whatever money that you people are willing to pledge and donate, Mr. Tona and Kotsidas will double it. That very day, we pledged, those people that were there, we pledged over $80,000. Of course, imagine they doubled. And then they went a little further. They says, whatever, they never expected that the community would raise that kind of money. They said, whatever the community raises, we'll double it. ended up with a community raising about $178,000. They doubled it and they built this for about $351,000.
Wow.
No mortgage or anything. That's the kind of benefactors that the community really needs.
Right. But what do you feel most proud of?
Well, I'm really proud, of course. I was always proud of my father for doing what he did. He tried hard to bring us up here and to get us together. Like, he had to make 2-3 trips back home, and he ended up coming down and bringing them himself. I was always proud of my father. He worked hard all his life. And I was even proud when the time he came that he brought his father here, a 90-year-old man, to bring him here to spend his last few years here with us, which we had grown up with, my brother and I and my sister. And I was proud of that. And I was really proud of this community here. That's why I stayed around in Worcester, where a lot of them have left since, you know. But I've always stayed here. I says, I'm not going to leave this community here. I've known so many people here all these years, since 1948 when I first moved here. And people like Mr. Kotsidas Antonis and Mr. Tsangarelis and Mr. Bell, a lawyer who's done a lot of work for the community. He's always been the lawyer for the church here, voluntarily, all volunteer work in this community all these years. Now it's getting to the point now everybody wants to get paid something to do something. That has changed a little bit. Still there's a lot of volunteers that do work, but there's not as many that are willing to put something in and without getting something in return. But other than that, this community is I'm very proud of this community.
Is there anything about, you know, the people you mentioned, Mr. Tonis, Mr. Katsidas, Mr. Bell, is there anything about them personally that you admired?
Well, first of all, Mr. Katsidas and Mr. Tonis, I didn't know them very well until the time when I served in at one time I served with both of them in the Board of Governors. After they got out the first time, they ran again later on. That's how those people were so interested in this community, in the welfare of this community. They ran again to run for the Board of Directors a few years later. As a matter of fact, on my second time around that I ran again, we got elected the same time again with them in the Board of Governors. And I admired them for that, because they never gave up on this community. They were the first to make big donations here, to come up with how to maintain this building here properly and have enough finances where we won't be in need and, you know, strive to. And I remember even Nicholas Drapers that I mentioned earlier. He worked very hard for this community. I was always proud of him. And as a matter of fact, himself and Jimmy Drapers, his brother, they were, and Mr. Bell especially, he was responsible for getting me, because he was a lawyer and I was an accountant. We happened to have practically in the same building, he had an office, and I was working with an accounting firm in the same office. He was my lawyer, and he was always a good advisor. Free, he never charged me a penny for any time I wanted some help, they had to give it to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, he used to, because I had volunteered myself for the community, so for those years, he appreciated what I, as a young man, you know, very few young men at that time were willing to come forward and work for the, you know, everybody's looking to make a living and raise a family and so forth. But I always felt they worked, one thing was together, they worked together. You know, you work for the community, you get help from the community also. I noticed that. I've never had anybody that not wasn't willing to give me a hand whenever I needed some help. Even when I was striving at the beginning, when I came out of college, I had a hard time finding a job. And I almost asked Mr. Kotsidas to go, but no, I wanted to stick in my county work instead. I waited until they come. Everybody, other businessmen, they said, well, you can do the work for my books for me part-time and so forth. And they helped me get with an accounting firm. And I appreciated that very much. And I admired Mr. Bell, because then he eventually got me to join the Order of AHEPA, which is the national organization of the Greek American Hellenic organization, which you at one time spoke at one of our luncheons here, which was really got us all interested in Ellis Island there. You were very instrumental in that to get everybody interested. And the AHEPA originally had helped a lot, Ellis Island, and I was one of the, because I happened to be with the AHEPA at that time. I went up all the way. I was, of course, an officer in the chapter, served all the chairs right up to president for 2 years, and I became a district lodge officer for 6 years. I was district governor, and I became a supreme governor. As a matter of fact, the time that you had the luncheon, I was supreme governor of the Order of Ahepa. And we were one of the first organizations to raise funds for the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island. If you remember, Mr. Iak Koka, mm-hmm. he was the chairman for the Statue of Liberty at the time in Ellis Island also. He came out and said originally, he mentioned it in a speech to the Italian club. He says, you know, he says, you, the Italians is the biggest ethnic group that ever came through Ellis Island was Italians. And he says, you ought to be ashamed of yourselves to let the Greek organization beat you to making pledges and donations for this project. You should have been the first. Instead, you let the Greeks be the first organization, national organization, to pledge at least $100,000, $150,000 to it. The restoration of Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island.
Well, I think maybe that's a good place to stop because we're at the end of this tape. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you so much for this interesting interview. Thank you.
It was a pleasure meeting you originally a couple of years ago, and it was a pleasure having this interview with you, Ms. Levine.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Christos Johns, and it's December 7th, and this is the end of tape 2, and this is Janet Levine, and I'm signing off.